The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
Okay, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 146. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the South Korean development process, how they came from being a purchaser of nuclear power plants to developing the ability to build them themselves, and now have successfully engaged in their first export sales to the United Arab Emirates. And with me I have Rick Turk, who has a lot of experience as a engineer from what was then combustion engineering and turned into ABB Combustion Engineering and later was purchased by Westinghouse. He was involved in the licensing of the System 80 Plus, which is the basis for the current South Korean work in nuclear, large nuclear power plants. And I also have Dan Yerman, who is a blogger at Idaho Samizdat. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rod.
Okay, Rick, so you have had some experience in how the South Koreans went about the process of developing their own ability to build nuclear power plants. Can you share a little bit about that experience with us?
Well, I think on their part it was certainly a long-term plan. When the contracts were let back in the mid-80s for their units, they were demanding technology transfer as a key part of the bids that they were reviewing and accepting from the U.S. industry. And at the time, I think all of the bids, to some degree, had technology transfer, and I think generally it's felt that CE, shortly become ABB CE at the time, won those bids based on their willingness to conduct that technology transfer with the Korean organizations.
Now, tell me, the bid process was sometime in the late 1980s, is that correct?
It was really mid-80s, as I recall, when they were bidding for their Yangwon Unit 3 and 4. Prior to that, they had built a number of units on a turnkey basis, the Cori units and a few others that they procured from multiple technologies, but primarily PWR technology. When they bid the units in for the Yangwon 3 and 4, it was, as I recall, limited to PWR technology. They had pretty well settled on that as the technology they wanted to move ahead with.
Yeah, I found an interesting article, editorial titled Korea Has Come a Long Way in Nuclear Technology, and it was describing how in the 1970s when Korea was buying plants from Westinghouse, the Korean technicians were not even allowed access to key areas and had to learn the ropes by looking over the shoulders of American engineers, and it also said that Korean nuclear technicians sent to Bechtel for training were kicked out because they were copying educational materials. So they were working pretty hard even back in the 70s to learn about this technology.
You know, I think that was key. And when Combustion was working with them in the 80s. There was a very deliberate program of technology transfer that really involved three phases. There was classroom training for them, and then there was essentially hands-on training in a non-production environment, and then there was on-the-job training. And during that time frame in Windsor, Connecticut, we had representatives from all of the Korean units essentially working side by side with our engineers as we did the design for those first units, the first units that Combustion supplied, Yangwon 3 and 4.
What was your perception of the work ethic and the safety culture in the Korean system?
I don't really have a perception of the safety culture in other than in terms of design safety, in which case they really absorbed the entire U.S. culture, 10 CFR 21 concerns, whatever. As far as the work ethic, I mean, it was extremely hard. I mean, they would often be around the office and working late hours, weekends. They were here in the U.S. to essentially assimilate the technology, and they worked very hard at that.
So they fit right into nuclear culture.
Very, very quickly. Essentially, developed a shadow culture, organized themselves to correspond with our organization, perform the basic functions and develop a very closely coupled organization of their own over the entire several years that it involved the design of those early plants and their startup.
Now, you were part of the effort to actually license those plants, the System 80 Plus, and get a design certification from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. One of the things that many people don't remember is that those certifications were actually issued back in, I think, about May 1997. What was that process like?
System 80 Plus, actually, I think the certification was earlier than that. But as part of our tech transfer, part of CE's tech transfer arrangements with the various Korean organizations, we had shared research and development activities. And really common with that in the mid and late 80s even was the start of the Electric Power Research Institute, the EPRI Utility Requirements Document, and Department of Energy, DOE's ALWR program. And as Combustion Engineering was participating in those, developing our System 80 Plus, the Korean organizations participated and joined and were part of that technology transfer. And on a basis somewhat behind that, started their development of what was called at the time the Korean Next Generation Reactor, KNGR. The evolution here was really on two fronts. One was related to power level, and one was related to design features. Recall that the only System 80 plants that finally were commissioned and operating were Palo Verde, but at the time, Combustion had as many as 8 units under design and under construction of that System 80 design, which is at Palo Verde, which was at the NRC's limit at 3,800 megawatts at the time. The bid to Korea for YGN 3 and 4 actually downsized that in terms of power level to a nominal 1,000-megawatt electric plant, but with the same features. And then in conjunction with the utility requirements document development in NEPRI, advanced features were introduced really in both sets of design. So they kind of matured and went on. And many of the features that were certified in System 80 Plus were, in fact, really all of the functional features that were certified in System 80 Plus were included in KNGR, Korean Next Generation Reactor, which then further evolved to APR 1400.
Hey, Dan, you got any questions? Just jump on in anytime.
Go ahead, Rod. You're doing fine.
Okay, thanks. All right. So these APR 1400s is what the Koreans actually won the bid with. They're, 1,400 megawatt electric, and I think they're somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,300 to $2,800 per kilowatt capacity. Is that correct?
I don't really have any feel for the actual cost numbers there, as they were either as they're being built in Korea or as they were bid. So I really can't comment on that.
Yeah, and there aren't any, as far as I can tell, looking at the World Nuclear Association website, there aren't any APR 1400s actually operating yet. There are some under construction.
The Shinkori 3 and 4 units in Korea are essentially that design, which they are, currently under construction. They, should be looked at as an evolutionary development beyond their essentially 1,000 megawatt units.
Right. They've got several of the 1,000 megawatt units actually operating, and the 1,400 or 1,350 net capacity units are supposed to go into operation in 2013-2014 time frame.
Correct.
So at least the folks in the UAE can see something that's progressing and is well ahead of what they're buying, so they can know and have something to base progress on.
Exactly. But I think the thing there is as much the design features. Size-wise, they're not really that big a step from the Palo Verde units. So as I pointed out, the evolution really occurred on two levels. We started with the Palo Verde, which were at the NRC mandated limit at their time of 3,800 megawatts thermal, and were actually downsized for the initial sale and the initial construction in Korea. So in both areas, both within the U.S. and in Korea, the advanced safety features of the utility requirements document were added, and then the scaling back up of the Korean units to, somewhat larger than what's in Palo Verde. But when you consider the uprates Palo Verde has gone through, they're not that much larger.
Right. It's within just a few megawatts, it seems to me.
Right. So it's truly an evolutionary design that's gone really on both sides of the Pacific.
And so far, the OPR 1000s, the actual System 80s that were made indigenous, what is Korea still having to purchase from Westinghouse? It seems that there's still an involvement there with Westinghouse.
Yeah, well, I really couldn't go into that. I mean, that would be, you know, information regarding Westinghouse's contracts. And
okay.
I don't think that's appropriate for me to comment on.
I do know that somebody's got an open mic there. Yeah, one thing that I found in some research is that the Koreans do seem to have a desire to get to the point where they can do everything themselves, not any particular goal in the as to when that will happen, but they're still trying to learn the rest of the technology, as far as I can tell.
I certainly think that would be the goal of any country, to be as self-sufficient as possible. And you know, their capabilities are certainly quite significant. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily any particular aspect of the technologies that they haven't mastered. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, understand. Yeah, you mentioned any country would want to be self-sufficient. That's any country except for the United States. We seem to want to outsource as much as we can. And I'm being sarcastic and not particularly pleased with that particular development, but you know, it seems like every time we have good ideas, we want somebody else to build them for us.
I'm not really going to comment on that.
Okay. So, what's your feeling towards why the System 80 pluses or the Advanced Light Water Reactor ABWRs never made it here in the U.S.
I wouldn't say that it never made it. I mean, they did get their certifications. I think it's timing. Right now, if you look at the pending COLs in the NRC, you've got a mix of essentially evolutionary and passive. Recall that the EPRI requirements document, and again, this gets a little historical going back to the late 80s, early 90s, but it was done in two volumes, one for evolutionary plants and one for passive plants. And there was certainly at the time a mixed feeling as to what might be potentially the best commercial option, and I think what we've seen is that really it is truly a matter of choice. There are some utilities, whether in the U.S. or overseas, that are opting towards an evolutionary approach for whatever reason, whether it's a feeling that there's reduced risk there or something, and others that are opting for the passive plant. And when I say passive, it's not only the passive, but the smaller, simpler design, because they may offer reduced costs or enhanced safety. And I think the jury's still out on whether it's one or both or none that finally make the grade.
Now, when you say evolutionary, just to make sure it's clear for those listeners, you're talking about plants that have additional safety features, maybe additional layers of protection or additional trains in the safety protection system, something like that, right?
But are predicated on the designs without essentially a significant new process or technology. Those were handles, you know, evolutionary versus passive, that were kind of placed on these two sets of requirements and two sets of designs that came out. But it's certainly a spectrum of potential designs.
So in the U.S., in you're talking about some of the designs, like we have the evolutionary power reactor, which used to be called the European power reactor, but the right. evolutionary power reactor, and then the advanced passive 1000, the AP1000. And I guess one has things like a tank that's a tank of water that uses gravity to get into the system, and another, the EPR, has additional safety-driven pumps. Is that
right? Well, yeah. One of the significant differences is passive safety systems versus active safety systems. It would also, you know, basic size. The idea that you know, smaller, simpler, eliminate a lot of the active components would increase reliability. So I think it's you know, truly a spectrum of design differences, which play to different needs or different priorities.
Well, that makes sense. Have you been following this bidding process that the UAE went through?
I don't really want to comment on that. I for a variety of reasons, but
okay.
Certainly have watched the press.
Yeah, I'm very excited about the fact that the announcement was made several months earlier than what was initially expected, and it seems like the UAE is going about the process of establishing nuclear power within their country in a way that's not going to offend people. In other words, they're doing things like agreeing to buy fuel and fuel services from outside and those kinds of things. Do you know much about how they're developing their regulatory environment?
No, I don't.
Rod, I have some details on that. I did a blog post on it. They have hired former NRC senior managers to set up a mirror organization in the UAE. As a matter of fact, last June, I did an interview with Dale Klein, who was then the chairman of the NRC, and he complained that the NRC was being raided for some of its talent, although one of the most senior person that the UAE hired had already retired from the NRC, so his complaints weren't entirely on point, but he did lose some other people. In any case, they held off until very late in the game, probably November, establishing the legal authority for that agency. It had been in development for several years, and they intend to operate the same way that the NRC does, with resident engineers, licensing process, and so forth. But they are operating in an entirely different arena than we're used to here, with public hearings, involvement of elected officials, public comment, and so forth. Their form of government is entirely different than ours, and their populations don't participate in government decision-making the way ours do. So I expect their regulatory costs concomitantly will be lower, and their processes will move faster, but I don't think that that will result in a diminished safety process or outcome.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I think that the 42-month process that the NRC publishes includes about 12 months worth of delays for hearings so and public comment.
Well, the NRC has a process that allows people to become interveners. You first have to establish standing, and then you have to get the technical merits of your argument dealt with, and then there's a hearing on it. And so the NRC is bound by its own regulations to consider interventions or intervener issues which they believe have technical merit, which they believe the interveners have standing. This is what's been so uproarious in the relicensing of places like Vermont Yankee, Indian Point, and Oyster Creek. I don't know if the UAE will have a similar process or not. I suspect most of their discussions will be directly with the licensee. And again, they don't have a democratic consultative government. And I don't know exactly how someone might proceed to file an intervention in that environment. It just would be a mystery to me.
Yeah, like you said, I think you can, under that form of government, which is not necessarily my favorite form of government, it sure makes it easier to build something large and complex like four nuclear power plants.
Yeah. I think the other thing to keep in mind is the UAE also has considerable concerns regarding security of those plants. It's an enormous amount of infrastructure. It's in a volatile region. There are plenty of people who, for a variety of reasons, would either like to disrupt those plants while they're being built or once they're operational. So their security interests are very significant, and they have contracted with a variety of international firms to address their security needs separate from the licensing issues. Now, there was a discussion in the Wall Street Journal today about whether or not they're how they would deal with airplanes crashing into containment buildings and so forth. This is an issue that we'll have to see exactly what their design structure is going to be for these plants. I'm assuming that there will be a containment structure of some kind for safety reasons, but I'm not sure that they're going to build it to American or Western European standards as far as how that's set up. It's very important, though, to keep in mind that the UAE has three broad strategic reasons for building these four nuclear reactors. The first is to get off of burning natural gas. Their natural gas supplies will probably run out in about 60 years, and they've been using it for both electricity generation and water desalinization. They want to get off of that as quickly as possible and use nuclear power for that process. The second is they have an aluminum industry where they would like to use nuclear power for making aluminum ingots. You use a lot of electricity for that and for making finished aluminum goods. They probably are going to fundamentally change the aluminum industry in the Middle East, if not globally, with their capabilities. And then the third is for general growth. They've also been using natural gas for electricity generation, and they want to get off of that and get out of using fossil fuels as much as possible for internal use, in part because they'd rather sell it overseas.
Yeah, Korea had a pretty good reason for moving towards nuclear power, that they didn't have their own indigenous fuel supplies, and they were paying a high price for imported liquefied natural gas since they were cut off from pipeline natural gas because of their rather disagreeable neighbor to the north. But that's a very similar reason from my point of view. That a lot of people say, well, geez, if you've got fossil fuels, why don't you burn them yourselves? But those fossil fuels are just as valuable on the export market. And, you have to charge yourself the price of those fuels.
That's right. The other thing is the UAE will probably become a regional exporter of electricity. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is very interested in buying electricity from these reactors. And if you look at the proposed locations, you'll see that they're designed in part to shorten the transmission and distribution line distance into Saudi Arabia.
Rick, do you have anything others that you think that'd be worthwhile sharing with regard to these designs and the infrastructure that is behind them, the training that went into the engineering and the you probably, from your point of view, don't have too much about the operator training, but
well, I think you again have to consider the time frame that's gone on with the Korean development here, talking about moving from their first turnkey purchases to now almost 25 years since they decided to make the technology transfer investments and work over, and that's included a tremendous amount of build up and training. When the first units were going through startup over there, they worked side by side with the startup teams here. They've developed their own training institutes, their own R&D institutes, their own architect engineer. Essentially, it was a very well planned multi-year, if not multi-decade, program of development. And as I said earlier, they did meet recently with the USNRC, and for those that are interested in the public document room, there's a pretty thorough presentation of how they developed their capabilities over the years.
Now, one of the things that hasn't happened yet that I know of is no American company has ordered or indicated that they're interested in a Korean-designed reactor. And I guess, as Dan mentioned, the aircraft impact rule, I assume since the System 80 Plus and follow-on reactors were designed before anybody thought about implementing an aircraft impact rule, I guess it was, just last year or something, that those probably didn't consider that. Although I've always said that if you look at a containment building and you look at a aluminum airplane, when the airplane hits the containment building, it'll go splat like a bug, but I can't prove that.
I honestly don't know what the situation is, but the Korean regulatory organization, certainly cooperates with and is aware of U.S. Considerations. So, I don't have any personal knowledge. I'm sure that's been discussed not only in Korea, but in and amongst their the bidding process in wherever they've presented that.
So I know that we don't have any haven't seen any new announcements of a new process starting a new company interested in nuclear plants, but it appears to me that at least my best guess is the next time a utility in the U.S. wants to buy a large nuclear power plant, they'll at least consider one more vendor compared to what was considered the last time somebody went through that process.
Well, certainly they're there to be considered, but one point I would make is that in the U.S. Process, the Parts 52 process, the idea is to obtain a certification of a design kind of independent of a customer. And so I think the pursuit of a certification, which was and again, I have no knowledge other than the fact that I saw the NRC public meeting notice, and I saw the public document room presentation by KEPCO. But that, whether there's a customer or not, the idea of a Part 52 certification is that you certify the design, and then it is available to whatever utility customer might want to pursue a combined operating license with that.
Rod, one of the things that we might want to consider regarding the Koreans and the U.S. market is supply chain. Right now, the only place you can get your heavy forgings is Japan Steelworks. My guess is that Korea's entry into the global market with the UAE award could stimulate that country to develop large forgings capabilities, in which case you wouldn't have to wait in line for 4 years with Japan Steelworks if you ordered your reactor from Korea. Assuming they have that up and running. The Indians also have indicated a desire to build a large forge, but I think that their announcement that they'll have the plant operational 2 years is optimistic, and that probably be closer to 10 before they're really capable of turning out four reactor vessels a year. So a supply chain also becomes an issue. If you're a utility, you're always looking at a second source for your supply chain. And if the Koreans enter the world market in that regard, it could facilitate their entry into the U.S.
Rick, do you know if the Koreans have built their own pressure vessels? I assume they probably built some of the other large components. I think the pressure vessel is the largest component and the only one that's really limited to that Japan Steelworks cube, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between building the vessel and, as Dan was talking about, obtaining the forgings. But yeah, Doosan Heavy Industry is producing not only their vessels, but has produced replacement vessels, steam generators, and the like for the U.S.
Okay. Rick, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us tonight. It's very informative. It's very interesting.
Well, you're welcome.
Dan, thanks for coming.
It's always a pleasure.
Hope that you enjoyed the opportunity to learn a little bit more about how the Koreans developed their nuclear capabilities.
I was fascinated to listen to Rick talk about the System 80 and the fact I really hadn't thought about Palo Verde as being a System 80. Of course, it is, as Rick pointed out, which means that there's U.S. experience with that design.
Lots of it. We've been
I think if you look again, I would encourage people to go hit the NRC public document room, search on APR 1400, and you can see a very extensive 153-page presentation by KEPCO as to the design and how it's related to System 80 and System 80 Plus.
And of course, one of the things that was great to hear, I pretty much suspected it because I've worked with a number of folks from South Korea over the years, but the idea that, you know, we have a bunch of very hardworking, dedicated engineers that really worked hard to learn their trade and have done so over the last 25 years should give people a lot of comfort knowing that it's companies like that that are out there, you know, building new nuclear power plants, and I guess they're going to be involved in operation based on what I've read about the bidding process there in the UAE. All right. Take care, guys, and hope you have a happy new year.
Happy new year.
I have a little outtake from the beginning of my phone conversation with Rick and Dan, and gives a little background on where Rick worked and what he did during his career. I thought that you might be interested. So, Rick, we'll do a little warm-up here while I'm making sure all the settings are right. you are a former ABB combustion engineering guy. What do you do now?
I've been doing some consulting in a variety of ways, mostly related to new plant issues. I left Westinghouse, retired from Westinghouse just about a year ago. I joined combustion engineering in 1977 after I left the Navy. Spent most of my time in the new build area. When I joined, we were in the final stages of licensing of Palo Verde, San Onofre, St. Lucie 2, Waterford. Then we went on to do a variety of small plant work for development, R&D contracts. And then I was the engineering manager for System 80 Plus as we took that through certification and made the bid for the Lungman job, which ABWR finally won. Worked with EPRI on the utility requirements documents, first of a kind engineering with DOE, and then just prior to the acquisition by Westinghouse, was with ABCE while we were bidding in China.
Did you actually get to go over to Korea during the build process there?
I've been to Korea several times, yes.
Okay, so were you involved in that building and startup process for those two System 80 reactors that they bought?
Yes, I was. And not only the building there, but then the development work that we had going on kind of in parallel. I think it's generally widely known, the ABB CE bid included a large technology transfer component, which many attribute to the success of the CE bid vis-a-vis its competition.
Yeah, it seems like the Koreans and the Japanese and the Chinese all had the same idea, which is they'll buy the first one or two, and then after that they'd build them.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves, and Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.